Maximize the quality and profitability of your post-harvest grains. For less than 6 cents per bushel, Diakon DIGR provides long-term insect control by ending infestations and preventing rebounds. Bush Agricultural Resources LLC has approved Diakon DIGR for use by its growers and companies that supply its growers. Help protect your stored grains with Diakon DIGR. For more information, contact your local dealer or visit bugfreegrains.com.
It's Farm Talk. I'm Mick Care. Well, planting season is over. Harvest season is a ways off. Haying season is around, but it seems like there are a couple of seasons that are never ending. Weed killing season and nutrient management season. That's kind of a never ending job, or at least something that you should never stop thinking about. And here's a guy who does never stop thinking about it, North Dakota State University Extension nutrient specialist. It's Dave Franzen. How are you doing today, Dave?
Good, Mick. How are you?
Well, no complaints yet. We got a good crop growing day.
Yeah, we do. Nice and warm. Some places got rain, but things are looking good.
Yeah. Generally speaking, are you seeing differences in fields out there for any particular reason that you are concerned about?
Well, you know, I think you've talked to people across the state, and in the West it's kind of a mess, you know, because it was so dry. It was so wet early and put the crop in wet because I had to, and then it got dry, and it's kind of still dry. So farther east you go, the better things look, sort of, but there's a lot of prevent plant here in the east, a lot of it. And you know, the crop that went in the ground, the wheat, I think, looks, you know, particularly good, and the beans are still struggling with the chlorosis, and the corn's coming on now. It's starting to get some height to it, so it's straightening out.
Yeah, that is good. All right, yeah, the yellow beans, that's an issue. That is that fertilizer based, or that's a soil chemistry thing, isn't it?
Fertilizer can have an interaction. So last year, If the soybeans are following wheat, and you know, maybe the wheat didn't do all that great and left some nitrogen in the ground, or it went in after corn and the corn didn't do that great and left some nitrogen in the ground, which I think is the problem on the farm that I'm sitting at right now. The nitrate messes around with the iron inside the leaf and prevents it from really being used. It causes precipitate. So some people soil test before their soybeans, and I think that's kind of a wise thing. We never used to think about doing that, but if you have soil tests that are rather high in nitrate, then maybe it's not the greatest field to put soybeans in, or if you do put soybeans in, putting in a companion crops like oats or barley or something like that, let them grow for a while. Let them take up some of that nitrogen. That seems to help.
Now, Dave, you're the fertilizer specialist. You put out fertilizer recommendations, and you've changed them a time or two here over the course of the years. But are you a proponent of tissue testing? Is that also, should that be a component of analyzing what's going on in the soil and in the plant?
I think in fields, and most fields are like that. Most fields, the greater majority, say, of the field looks pretty good, but then there's this area that doesn't look all that great, and you can't really pinpoint it as an area that was excessively wet in the spring, or you just can't figure out what's going on. It's a good thing to do to try to narrow down the possibilities. I even had a request here a week or two ago about tissue test or plant analysis to try to figure out if it was really iron chlorosis or not. And I, you know, my short answer was, if you see it, you got it. But if you want a little bit more proof, so the biggest mistake that people would make if they were doing tissue tests is just take one for the field or one for the bad area, or because the tables that the labs refer to are just pretty general. And in an individual situation, the actual numbers that are really sufficient or deficient can vary quite a little bit. So it's best to, within a variety, within a field, look at a good area, look at a bad area, take a sample from each, multiple leaves, of course, and make a note of the growth stage that you're taking it from, because most of the nutrients become dilute as the concentration becomes less as the crop matures. And so if you have an area that's more mature and you have a lower reading, you think, oh my gosh, I have a problem. But really what you've done is you've just taken it at a later maturity and it's actually okay. But anyway, take a paired analysis, one good, one bad. When you get the results back, it'll become clear if something's really out of line or not. If both the good and the bad, the values that you get from the various nutrients are kind of within the range of okay, then there's something else going on but nutrients, and you have to dig deeper, no pun intended. Sometimes just using a shovel is not a bad thing to do to try to figure out what's going on.
All right.
So that's how I would handle it. I think it has a place, but paired analysis, good versus bad, but in a field, hopefully within a variety, that's the best diagnosis you can get.
Excellent. Yeah, different than a soil test for a grid or zone map representing the whole field. Focus on a problem area and get your answer there. Super.
Yep.
Hey, Dave,
the other thing is, I didn't mean to walk on you, but this harkens back to the question about the tissue sampling for the iron chlorosis. If iron is important to the farmer, those plant samples have to be washed off with distilled water before they're taken to the lab, because if it has dust on it, and all leaves do have dust on it, or mud splashes or something, there's a lot of iron in the soil, and so that will contaminate that plant sample and give you unrealistically high readings, even when the plants are obviously iron deficient. So I wanted to make sure I put that in there to make sure that if iron is important, to wash the sample with distilled water.
Wow, and what's the greatest problem for well water out on the farm? Iron.
Iron, you bet.
Yeah. Yeah, so we got it. All right, distilled water, excellent. All right, well, I was going to ask you, are you seeing a lot of top dressing for wheat this year? I mean, all the prices for all the commodities are in the toilet. Is it worth it?
So there are a lot of stages of wheat right now. We're probably looking at they're really late planting, getting into the 5-leaf, 6-leaf, something like that. If that wheat is 5-leaf, 6-leaf, hasn't really passed early jointing, and there still needs to be nitrogen applied to that field, it's still time. You still can do that. So you put urea on, make sure you have a good urease inhibitor on it. If you stream 28% or something like it, then you shouldn't need that. And only stream when it's not super windy, because you don't want to broadcast 28 over wheat, or it'll make it the color of toast. So you don't want to do that. So that'll result in a yield increase. But if the wheat is beyond that, or certainly when it's heading or be right before heading, flag leaf, something like that, putting nitrogen on at that stage isn't going to affect yield hardly at all. So it's not cost effective. We're getting into the period where probably the wheat that's farthest along is in that early post-anthesis stage. And I don't know what to tell people about protein or whether it's going to be protein premium or not. People have to make up their mind whether it's going to be worth it or not to do something like that. But if you get into that right after flowering stage and a farmer thinks that he really needs to beef it up a little bit so that he makes sure that he makes the protein grade or a little bit higher, then 10 gallon of 28, 10 gallon of water mixed together, put on with flat fan nozzles, cool of the day. That's the plan. That's the recipe. That'll give a farmer, you know, half a point, maybe up to a full point of protein increase. But again, person needs to pencil it out and see if it's going to be worthwhile for them to work with that.
All right. Yeah. Yeah, who knows? It's the big roulette wheel we spin every year. And I know there's varying reports on the Kansas and Oklahoma combining that protein's kind of all over the place. But it is a little bit to the downside this year. So, alrighty, the last question I'm going to ask you, Dave, is more of an agronomy question versus a fertilizer question, but farmers are experimenting with varying row widths, and obviously, is it all population, or is a varying width of whether it's, 15 or 30 inch rows of soybeans or 15, 30 inch rows of corn? Do row widths utilize fertilizer differently?
Well, the soybean work that they've done, particularly in Carrington, but at other of our stations, the fertilizer really doesn't seem to interact all that much with it. Although one of the things they found with soybeans is that a person really shouldn't put fertilizer down with the seed because it's almost never helpful and sometimes very harmful. So they did figure that out. There's a new circular out that the person could look at on their smartphone or download on the web that talks specifically about row widths and soybeans. And Hans Condell, Greg Andrus, and several others have done work on this. And so it's all compiled and in that nice circular. So I'd encourage people to take a look at that.
All right.
In the corn, most of our corn is, once you get outside the valley, is 30-inch rows. There's some 20s, some 22s. When you get into sugar beet country, and in the higher yield, the narrow row spacing seemed to rule. Although I've taken 250 bushel corn off with 30-inch rows, you can, I guess you got to get to that step before you go to another step. I think what you're alluding to is the 60-inch row corn that people are trying out.
Well, not quite.
Was that
quite
even on your mind?
I guess that is eventually that'll have to be a consideration. Now, I was just thinking whether it's solar radiation on the soil or varying, again, not considering plant population, does the width of the row have anything to do with nutrient uptake?
Not at those rows. The narrow rows support a higher population and a higher yield potential in the corn, at least down to 22, 20-inch rows, something like that. I've heard of people going to 15s, but I really haven't seen any research. I haven't studied the research on going quite that narrow.
Okay.
But when we went from 40 to 38 to 36 to 30, certainly higher populations are possible, and the yield potential has gone way up.
Yeah, and what Mike Ostley and Kelly Cooper are doing with 60-inch rows, I guess that's a whole other discussion for another day, Dave.
Good, because I don't want to just walk into that.
Yeah, I'll talk to them about it, and then you guys can put your heads together, and we'll figure out a nutrient plan for 60-inch corn rows and whatever is going on in between that 5 feet. So, alrighty, hey Dave, thank you very much. Have a good day, stay cool, and have a great 4th of July.
Thank you. You too.
You bet. Dave Franzen, NDSU nutrient fertilizer specialist.